Bob Geldof was the leader of the Irish rock group the Boomtown Rats when in 1984 he saw a TV report about the famine in Ethiopia. He says he wanted to send money, but he thought that wasn't enough. But he asked himself what else could he do. He thought of himself as a not very successful pop singer who could only make records that no one bought. Even so, he thought he'd make the gesture of donating the profits of his next record to Food for Ethiopia. Then he got a better idea, to organize some of Britain's biggest rock stars to record a song together and donate the profits. That group effort became known as Band Aid. Their single, Do They Know It's Christmas, became the best-selling single of all time in England. That led Geldof to organize the international benefit concert Live Aid. It was held in July 1985. All told, his efforts have raised $140 million. Geldof was nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize, won the United Nations World Hunger Media Award, and was knighted by the Queen of England. But he was also criticized for not featuring many black performers in the Live Aid concert, and questions have been raised about how he has managed the money. In the interim, Geldof's band, the Boomtown Rats, has broken up, and he's embarked on a solo career. He's also written an autobiography titled Is That It?, and it's just been published in paperback. He's joining us today from the NPR Bureau in New York. Before we meet him, this is Geldof singing with the Boomtown Rats. Bob Geldof, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Let's talk about Live Aid a little bit. I got the impression from the end of your book that you were kind of anxious to leave in a way and to start on whatever your next project will be. Is that right?
It's not that I was so much anxious to leave that behind me. It's that the whole point about Band Aid was that it should have built-in obsolescence because I never wanted it to be an institution. I never wanted it to repeat what Oxfam or CARE or Save the Children do admirably. It was supposed to be an expression of anger, and had it continued, it would have lost that sense of immediacy and possibility that perhaps it had. As it stands now, it still exists, and I'm still chairman of it, and we have about, about $22 million left to spend from the total. Thank God, because the situation is increasingly bad over there again.
What's the money primarily being used for now?
Primarily it's on long-term development projects, which can range from massive dams to tiny little holes in the sand that gather up water and you cover with a tarpaulin canvas. It ranges through mainly agricultural projects, irrigation, reforestation, terracing, soil rehabilitation, orphanages, trucking. We have 622 wheelers there. Emergency aid, medicine, food, house, shelter, that sort of thing.
Is using money to help end a famine more difficult than you thought it was going to be when you started this project?
No, not at all. I mean, it will not end the famine, which is why the pun in the first place, a Band-Aid on a gaping wound. It's not possible to solve it. It was to be, an expression of compassion and anger and possibility. Famine is a political problem. It is not an environmental problem.
Were you ever afraid when you realized how much money you were going to get from Live Aid? It's quite a responsibility to oversee that much money.
Well, I mean, I constantly underestimate. I'm useless at that sort of thing. I thought the Band-Aid record was going to make £70,000, and £8 million later, I was a bit overwhelmed. And then Live Aid, I remember saying to the trustees, I said, I estimate about £10 million. And then when we got £10 million alone from one sponsorship company, I didn't know what the hell would happen, you know. So, no, not really. It's not that. I mean, what happens is that the actual physical requirements of accepting that money from all over the world is difficult. You have to talk to practically every banking system literally on the planet, every post office in the planet. The last call I made before going to bed the night before Live Aid was to the Norwegian Postmaster General. And it was that sort of mundane thing that people don't think about. They think, hey, pop stars, you know, and stuff like that. But in fact, I was talking to more bankers and postmasters to for the, you know, to make sure the post offices were able to receive money and things. And when you're dealing with people in Nepal and New Caledonia, it's difficult.
In your book, you describe that during the peak of Live Aid, that you were hit with the God syndrome, that a lot of people saw you as being saintly. What's the God syndrome? Describe that.
It's which, been,
that which you named the God syndrome.
It's been being approached with the moist eye to touch the hem of the garment, you know. It's very irritating.
Well, from the way you describe it, you would greet people with expletives who...
If I was angered by it, you know, I mean, I was angered that people, I mean, I got the cranks as well, people writing to me telling me I was one of the 12. 12 what? What are they talking about? Or one of the nine? Nine what, you know? I mean, and it was the same thing, it was as preposterous, you know. I dislike it very much, you know, and that people, like, I mean, some people would come over and say, I remember a vicar saying to me, if Christ was here, he'd be with you, you know, or some nonsense like this. And, you know, it just irritated me that they would always remove it from human experience and somehow make it divine. And that irritated me profoundly. I met Mother Teresa, and she was an absolutely startling person. I mean, without doubt, the most incredible person I've ever met. And... but she said to me that she saw the suffering of Christ. We were both in Addis, I think, at the time, in these people. And that irritated me a lot, and I had a big argument with her about her, because I said to me, it's a denial of God if you believe in God, and I'm quite iffy on the subject. It seemed to me to be a complete denial of that being. I mean, if you are of the Judeo-Christian, a tradition, then you believe that God gave us free will, and in so doing, then we must choose to allow these things to exist, and God must spit in our eye that we do.
As much as you really hated being thought of as saintly, did you ever have to wrestle with a Superman problem yourself? I mean, having gotten that much money, having organized such a big event and gotten so many awards and international publicity, did it have any bad effects on your own ego, which could really get pretty inflated after pulling off such an event?
Americans are obsessed by ego. They always ask me about pop stars' egos, and was that not the main problem? I mean, they, you know, I mean, postmaster generals have bigger egos than pop stars. I don't think ego's certainly not a problem for me, because, you see, it was just an organic thing. It grew on a day-to-day basis. There was a problem, like, for example, how the hell do we collect this money? So you went and found out about it, and then did something about it. And I think, viewed from outside, you know, you see this person doing this sort of thing, and you think, gosh, that's great. And, gosh, I wish we were all like that sort of thing. And, of course, the point about Band-Aid was that anybody could have done it. And certainly, I'm not sure about here, but in Britain, I remember saying that this situation is not about charity, it's about a moral imperative. The imperative that you must do something, or else you're guilty of complicity to murder, because we saw it on our TV screens. We had the means to stop it. And if we didn't stop it, how guilty are we then, all of us? And so, no matter what it is you do, yes, send money, but more important, give something of yourself. And I don't know what you're capable of doing, but you're capable of doing something. And as a result, you had secretary aid and town planners aid. I mean, God knows what the town planners did, but they did something using their own skill. And that's what I was doing. I was using what I had, i.e. the ability to write songs, the ability to play them, and the ability to have access to the media.
Bob Geldof is my guest. He organized Live Aid and Band-Aid, and his autobiography, Is That It?, has just been published in paperback. It seems to me that you really saw, in a way, that the best and also the most exploitative parts of people while organizing Live Aid. You saw the best in that people were really willing to make a lot of personal sacrifices and give a lot of their time, their intelligence, and their money as well.
Mm.
On the other hand, you saw people really wanting to exploit the heck out of this effort and have their logo near your logo and jockey for the best airtime and, you know, use it for commercial reasons and self-promotion and so on. Where did you draw the line in where you didn't want? I know people had to get something out of it in order to participate, but was there a line that you would draw where you'd say, no, this is just exploitation? You can't use your logo with ours, or you're not going to get this prime time or whatever?
Well, I dispute you there. I don't think maybe 0.3% of people wanted to get anything out of it. Certainly none of the bands, with the exception of two or three, ever bothered me about where their position on the bill was or anything like that. And subsequent to Live Aid, you know, people were saying, huh, you know, and I suppose they sold lots of records. I can absolutely categorically state that I doubt if any band, I mean, are you kidding me? Do you think David Bowie needs any more publicity than he's got, you know, or needs to sell any more records than he already has? That wasn't a question. Where people wanted to get something, I guess, was in commercial sponsorship. But I would view that simply as a business transaction. I had to try and screw as much out of them as I possibly could, and I was prepared to do anything. I mean, I remember a phone call. Pepsi, as they say in America, came on board very early on, and Coke were really miffed, but they had had their opportunity, and they rang me one Sunday from Atlanta when I was at home watching telly, and they said, look, Bob, you know, we really want to get something here. And I said, I'm sorry, but we've already sold the logo sort of thing to Pepsi. And they said, well, is there anything else? And I invented on the spot the term the global jukebox and told them that I had a logo for this, and they asked, could they buy that? And I had somebody knock up a global jukebox that afternoon and faxed it over to Atlanta. So, you know, I mean, who's exploiting who? I would take anybody that I possibly could in order to help those people, and I think I was morally justified in doing that. As for them being able to take me, it was only a question of how far you perceived that they were exploiting you. And as I say at one point, part of the book, the record industry is fine if you go into it with the basis of you scratch my back and I'll claw yours. And it's just a question of who's got the sharper fingernails. With regard to bands jockeying for position, that happened with only one or two people.
We know what I want to ask you about bands. I'm sure there were a lot of bands who wanted to be on Live Aid who you really didn't want to be on because you could get better bands.
No, it wasn't a question of better bands. To me, again, it came down to everything was pragmatic. It wasn't a question of personal choice.
But here's what I mean. What would you tell a band who wanted to be on, who was really willing to give of their time and effort, but you really didn't want them on the bill? How would you handle that?
It wasn't that I didn't want them. I would simply say you don't sell as many records as Joe Blow. And that's it. And if you sell 10,000 records and you're a great band and this guy sells 10 million... I'll take the 10 million because if 10% of that 10 million would give money, it's better than 10% of the 10,000.
You said before that you didn't think that any of the bands really got the kind of publicity that helped them sell more records from this, or that they needed that kind of publicity.
They probably got the publicity, but they didn't need it. That was the least motivation. In fact, I'm fed up with people going on about bands. They are, by and large, the most intelligent group of people that you could possibly work with. They have less ego because their ego is constantly flattered by playing live than, say, well, radio journalists, for example, or bankers, or stuff like that. So this sort of base motivation that people somehow consider the world of pop to be plastic and artificial is nonsense. It is not. And nor are they.
So you think too much is being made of this?
I think that people who don't understand people in pop music.
Let me ask you one question that you're really going to hate. Okay. Your band never had quite caught on in America, the Boomtown Rats.
Yeah, right.
And your records, you know, solo and with the band, never really caught on in America like it did in Europe.
Mm.
How did all the attention of Live Aid affect your own recording career?
In a negative sense, as you said, my solo career hasn't really exploded with the fireworks one would have desired. But in a negative sense, because people constantly ask me about Live Aid, which is fair enough. And then in the sense that if you go into a rock radio station with my record, they'll scrutinise it. lyrically. And then they'll put on the record and say, hey, here's Bob Geldof, a really great guy. You know, we all owe him one. Let's play his record. As if, you know, they're doing me a big favor by playing my record. Look, play my record if you like it. Don't play it if you don't like it. But don't think you're doing me favors. The net result is that if they play a record and it doesn't sell, when I come in with the second record, they say, hey, come on, Bob, we've done you a favor, you know. It's as if I'm sort of some sort of dilettante pop singer. In fact, that's how I pay my electricity bills. And I've been playing pop music since 1975. In fact, the music is a byproduct of the way I think. And Band-Aid was only a byproduct of that music.
Well, I want to talk with you more about your musical career, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is Bob Geldof, who organized Live Aid and Band-Aid and is the author of an autobiography titled Is That It?, which has just been published in paperback. We'll talk more after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Bob Geldof is my guest. I want to talk with you a little bit about growing up in Ireland and getting your band organized there. You write in your autobiography that you hated being a teenager, you longed to be 20, and you said now life at 20 could begin. The 60s were dying, and I was delighted. Why did you hate being a teenager and also hate the 60s?
The 60s were very indulgent and maybe necessary, but in retrospect a little silly. And a lot of their values were, I thought at the time, naive. And I still think... with the ever-increasing rejection of those values, a little wrong. And I hated being a teenager because I think it's an intensely tedious time anyway. You live your life in almost a permanent state of not only physical confusion, but also mental confusion. And... You're equipped with all the faculties to be able to operate on this planet, but in fact you can't use them, and you know your sexuality is confused. You still must conform to school and home and all those things, and that was okay. But I wasn't having a very pleasant life anyway.
Well, you say something. You mentioned sex. You said something that I thought was very, very funny. You spent a lot of time in your early teens masturbating, and you said you were afraid you were going to use up your quota of orgasms. And I thought to myself, how many people really thought this when they were young, before they knew what was what?
Yeah, well, I mean, Hemingway thought it all through his life, you know. But it's, yeah, I did. I mean, obviously everybody masturbates a lot, I think, when they're a teenager. Everybody seems to have picked up on this fact in the book, incidentally.
Oh, really?
especially guys, they always go, huh, God, Bob, you know, they talk a lot about masturbating. In fact, they use, you know, other terms as I do. But and the funny thing is that they all pretend they don't do it now. You know, I grew out of that when I was 18, you know. Grew out of what? It's great fun, you know. I mean, what do you want to grow out of it for? And it's, you know, like, they'd all go, and I'd say, well, of course, you know. They'd say, like, well, do you still do it? And I'd say, yeah, when I feel like it, you know.
Well, another thing I noticed in your biography is that you have a real gift for organization and for getting attention.
Yes.
But you also have a real gift for really alienating people, for being... so outspoken as to be really rude and nasty. For instance, you were on the Irish Late Late Show. I've never seen the show, obviously, but I guess there's a lot of bands that are on.
No, it's like
talk
a talk show. Yeah.
Oh, like the Tonight Show or something?
A little more serious than the Tonight Show. It takes into account issues and those sort of things rather than... well, it does take into account a show like this, say a book plugging type affair.
Right. So you're on the show and you're talking about how much you hate Dublin and how your father used to beat you, and of course your father was watching. I really wondered. This is before you were
known.
Yeah. And
it was a very.
I wondered what got into you to say all of that on television.
A lot got into me. My background got into me. It was my first revenge. And I seized it. You talked originally about my organisational sense. Because my mum died when I was six or so, and my older sister had cancer and was given a year to live in the same year, my father was away all week except at weekends, and so he was completely distraught, and he had no money. And my sister went away to Lourdes, which is a Catholic religious shrine in France, and came back cured, miraculous, our mental power. It doesn't matter. But so he was off doing this thing and was like, really caught up in that. And so I was left to my own devices. And you start to organise your life because you have to. And at the age of 8, you have to make sure that there's enough food in to eat, and you have to make sure you order the coal for the fire because Dublin is a damp city. And so you learn to organise yourself. You also learn very quickly self-sufficiency and independence. And what happens is that when you have independent action, independent thought follows quickly. And so not only do you have an organisational capacity, but you begin to articulate things you believe. And if anybody then tries to temper that opinion, which would normally happen in a normal household, your parents or your brothers and sisters would temper your opinion. In my household, that didn't happen, so I became dogmatic. And the organisational sense manifested itself early in only the two things that interested me, politics and music. I wasn't interested in sport. And I organised the campaign for nuclear disarmament and joined anti-apartheid at 14. And so, because my father was away except at the weekends, this man was a stranger to me. And because I was independent, he would try and discipline me. And so he beat me a lot. And in school, I was beaten every day at least once. And so when the time came to run out of those gates and out of the door of my house, I did so. And at the moment where I could exact revenge, it was a very public revenge. It meant finally I had a platform to talk about the things that bothered me. And it was on television and on the major network show, and I exacted that revenge.
Bob Geldof is my guest, the organizer of Live Aid and Band Aid, and he's written a new autobiography titled Is That It? Tell me if this is an apocryphal story or not. A friend of mine who used to manage a record store told me that when one of your Boomtown Rats records came out in America, that there was a promotional campaign for the record in which dead rats were sent out. Is that true?
Yes, unfortunately, yes it is.
Whose idea was that?
It was the record companies at the time. They thought this would be hip.
And was it?
No. I mean, it was like the rats were in plastic formaldehyde, you know, so they were preserved and stuff like that, you know, in this plastic bag. And it was 1977, which was sort of the apogee of the new wave punk thing. And they thought that this was sort of the American way of getting this launched. And of course, I think they misunderstood the whole thing violently. I think they misunderstood it. The whole New Wave thing was about reassessing those attitudes of selfishness, which were the result of the 60s self-indulgence, the selfishness of the 70s. And pop music reflected that with a sort of limousine lifestyle. And all the bands in Britain that were operating this new type of ethic rejected that utterly, and it was about that. It was about reevaluating pop music and questioning where it was going and trying to pull it back onto the rails, which worked.
Did you want to stop the company from sending out these dead rats as a promotional gimmick?
To be honest, I didn't know about it, but whether I had have known about it or not, I don't know whether I would have stopped it or not. I don't know whether I'd have thought at the time, this is neat, this will upset people, or this will make them, you know, jolt a bit sitting behind their desk deciding what records they'll play and what they won't play. But it did hurt us in terms of our career, yes.
I think it might have hurt you on two levels. One is that some people would have been offended to get the dead rats. And the other is I think some people thought it really rang false to have like a record company sending out the dead rats, being, you know, trying to come off as so like daring and avant-garde.
I think they're right, you know. I mean, as John Lennon said, avant-garde is the French for bullshit.
You know, you've had this obsession, I think, through your life with being exposed to extremes. You describe going to South Asia for the first time and just really shopping for extremes, to see something as extreme as in The Deer Hunter. And what you got exposed to was a kind of bizarre sexual display, really.
It isn't that I'm obsessed with extremes. It's that I want to experience things in order that I may question my own feeling towards them. And if you've read the book, then I gather you'll have got that from it, I hope. it is a sort of act of moral cowardice, I suppose, ultimately. It is vicarious through, but it goes beyond that to a certain degree, because I do want to find out what certain things are like. And also it comes down to the plain fact that I at one point say in the book that the only real sin is wasting time, and I absolutely agree with that, that that's for me an absolute truism. You have 70 years possibly, if you're lucky, in this life, and out of all infinity, that seems to me to be a bit of a raw deal, in which case why waste a second of it, and try and do everything you're capable of, which is less than some people and more than others, without hurting anybody, and that to me would be what I would imagine life has got to be about.
Well, the extreme that you were exposed to that moved you the most and changed your life the most was obviously the Ethiopian famine.
It wasn't the extreme, the worst extreme, to be honest, I've been exposed to, but it was the one that probably had the most ultimately profound effect on my life, willy-nilly.
So how has that changed your interest in looking for extremes? I mean, because this was not just a kind of like freak show extreme for you. Do you know what I mean? This
yes,
was something
exactly.
You really sank your life into.
It was by accident that my life got caught up in it, because I had reacted to it, as I said to you earlier in the interview, by saying, well, this demands something of myself. It's nothing to do with charity. It's to do with moral imperative and intellectual absurdity. And in the end, it became, no matter what way you looked at it, a source of human shame. And more than anything, that's the thing that irritated me. And so I set out to do something about it. And consequently, I did see things and was involved in things that no human being should ever have to see.
What's happening with your performance career now? Are you going to continue to record and perform?
Yes, I've just, last night I flew in from Australia, where I've been touring. Obviously trying to get back to playing music. I mean, some people obviously view as maybe a little bit pathetic, certainly a little trite after what they consider, you know, to be something important, as I do consider important, but they must understand that music to me is critically important for the good of my soul, let alone anything else. Band-Aid is something that I have to do. Music is something I want to do.
Okay, well, Bob Geldof, I want to thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Bob Geldof has been my guest. He organized Band-Aid and Live Aid, and is also a composer, songwriter, singer. His new book, Is That It, is an autobiography that's just been published in paperback. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.